Welcome to the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast with your co-hosts Matthew Davis and Matt Kupferle.
Welcome to episode 13 of the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I'm your co-host Matt Kupferle, and we will be doing another one of our strategy episodes, and this time we are joined by the illustrious, I don't know even how many different superlatives I can give, Mr. Brian Vogel of the NFBC. Brian, thanks for hopping on tonight.
You guys are really scraping the barrel. I appreciate it.
Well, you know what? Thanks for you. Congratulations to my co-host partner, Matthew Davis. You guys know him as Matty Wood. Had his first baby over the weekend. So you will be stuck with me, Brian, unfortunately, but I think we'll have a good time talking about your strategy, what you've done in the past. For those that don't know Brian, some rundown, and we'll go from there. So, Brian, let's get to it.
Sounds good.
We are lucky to have you on. You have been a vet of NFBC. You started playing back all the way back in 2008, and I'm guessing things maybe were a little bit different. When you started playing in 2008, Brian, I know when I started, I was kind of just in with satellite leagues and I hadn't jumped in. How did you kind of jump into the water? Did you dip your toe in like I did, or did you just jump right into the deep end off the diving board?
I kind of jumped right in. It's funny, you know, you play your home leagues and at a certain point you start dominating or whatever. And I thought, okay, you know, it was fun. I'd still continue doing this. And I was reading a book and I came across the NFFC. And I thought, wow, I wonder if they have a baseball championship. And this was 2007, and they did, but it was too late to sign up. So I was really pumped up to get into it in 2008. And to prepare, I did a couple satellite leagues prior to the season.
Cool.
And then just showed up in Vegas and did my main event and was overwhelmed.
Well, and, we'll tell about a story when I was overwhelmed playing against you for the first time last year, but I totally get it. You played a lot of different leagues, draft champions, satellite leagues, like you mentioned, onlines, no mains. Unfortunately, no main titles yet, but I'm sure that's coming soon. For some background on Brian, he started in 2013, finished 15th overall in a draft champions league. And then there was the primetime format, which I think you corrected me, Brian, in pre-show prep. Was primetime the old main? Is that what it's called in NFBC lingo? Is that what that was?
I think it was the first year that they did higher stakes online championships.
Ah, okay.
Most of the online championships are 350, and this was, I believe, the first year they raised.
Got it. Okay, so they were just channeling like their inner Deion Sanders. Primetime is what
something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you were 57th that year, which is when you really started to get cooking. 2016, another top 75 finish. You finished 63rd. And then probably one, Brian, that you felt, you know, vindicated you a little bit, but it's always fun to see it pay off. A third overall in the OC. Ironically, you finished third. The overall winner that year was a friend of mine, Chris Oliver, that won the overall online championship. He is married to his wife, played soccer with my wife in college, which is just totally happenstance. And then finishing second, I think, was John Posma, who's a really good friend of yours and who we competed against. And I know you play in a bunch of leagues. Is that right? First, second, third?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay. And I remember talking to Chris because 2018, if I remember correctly, was one of those years with the dreaded Monday games, right?
Oh, God, you know, that was probably right, but it was really close that last week.
It
was a little bittersweet for me because I led it for so long, and then the last week they caught me. But
if
there was a play-in game, it had no effect.
Right?
Come again?
You led for a long period of time in that online championship, correct?
Yeah, I always, in my head, I equate it to like leading the Indianapolis 500 for, you know, 200 laps or whatever, but not the finish line.
Well, that's definitely stings, but, you know, third overall, not the worst finish you could ever have. And then when we look at last year, Brian, which I think is just a testament to how good of a player you are, you won five draft championship leagues, which includes Fantrax, two overall league titles, and you and I got to know each other from playing in an online championship that was my, which I've told on the podcast before, but for those that haven't heard it, I started playing in the NFBC in 2017. This is my fourth year. 2019 was the first year that I did any online championship, and I go out to Vegas every year with my buddies, Scott, Pat, Brian, and my buddy Dustin. We've gone together the last couple of years together. A bunch of us played college baseball together. Dustin and I are friends through our kids. Brian's a buddy of Scott's from high school. It's been a long-running thing. We've been going out for years. And I finally thought in 2019, well, you know, I'm already out there, and I don't fly home until Sunday, and I'm kind of stepping up my chops. So why not, you know, put a third bullet into the entry in the OC? Wow, was that a terrible choice on my part. Playing against you, playing against Hall of Famer John Posma, playing against Hall of Famer Sean Childs. I'm sure I'm forgetting some other people that were in that league as well. I remember James Nicola was in our league, and I know James, I've seen his name all over leaderboards. Man, that was an absolutely loaded league. And I felt like I just got out alive to finish fifth in the 12-team league. But that draft, which is a league that you won, Brian, it felt like there was just, you know, blood in the water, I'm sure, when I was there. But that was a really fun way for me to learn. You joked earlier, did you kind of have a similar learning curve when you jumped into that first main, like you mentioned, in 2008?
Yeah, it was, you know, I was prepared, as anybody that's going to spend that amount of money. I hope everybody prepares. And I kind of mapped out how I wanted the draft to go. And of course it didn't go that way, but I still
thought didn't go that way at all.
I still thought I was in good shape.
Yeah.
And we got to the first break after round 10 and, you know, everybody kind of gets up and mills about and looks at draft boards. And I was looking at mine and thinking, okay, what's my plan for the next, 10, 20 rounds. And Kent Sturman, he's a veteran. And we did a satellite together. So we had kind of emailed a couple times and he comes over and says, what do you think? I said, well, you know, it didn't quite go as planned, but I think I'm doing okay. And he just looked over and said, I'm sorry to tell you, bud, you're dead in the water.
Well, and that was a live league in Vegas, or was that a different location?
No, that was a live main event. And it was a wake-up call. I mean, I didn't want to believe that, of course. And then after about 2 weeks into the year, I realized he was absolutely correct.
Why were you dead in the water? What was off with your strategy, or what did you miss?
I had gambled on some young players. I mean, it's in my DNA to take some risk, and took too many risks, and it just didn't pay off, you know. And it took me probably a couple months to kind of get the hang of FAB.
Yeah.
So it was definitely, you know, an expensive learning experience, but you know, I had a good time, good enough time that I've been coming back just about every year.
Sure. Well, and we'll talk about that too. I mean, I think it's important to understand, and it's a learning curve always. I mean, I think even between, you know, Matthew does a great job of highlighting, even in main events versus onlines, the aggressiveness and the difference that you see in the style is critically important to understand in all these leagues, right? So it's just a challenge, and there's certainly a learning curve, and you're playing against some of the brightest minds, which is a great way to test yourself and your theories and kind of what you think about things. So,
absolutely.
So we've got a couple topics, Brian, that I want to kind of use as our outline. That's what we've done in the past. But certainly we kind of want you to go off on a tangent and take us with your kind of knowledge and skill set. So first I want to talk about what I think is most interesting, Brian, as you and I have talked, is you have a league with probably some of the biggest names in the high stakes fantasy baseball league industry. The name of the league is escaping me. It's the premature league that you guys start the last week of September, typically. Does that sound about
right? We start the last weekend of the regular season. So we're still we're drafting for the next season while the current season is still going.
Okay. And that league has Greg Blankenship, John Posma, name some of the others.
Posma's not actually in that one. He's in a few of the other ones.
Okay.
That one's got Lindy Hinkleman, you know, arguably one of the best players, or not even arguably, he is one of the best players. John Stadtmuller, Dan King, and, you know, Todd Zola, Derek Van Riper, they share a team.
Great.
A ton of other guys. I mean, I don't want to you know, dismiss anybody. Everybody in that league is a great player.
No, sure. No, and what I do think that highlights, Brian, is that I think the biggest thing you talked about, and I'd like to hear your thoughts, but that league kind of sets the tone and is kind of your way you start to feel out, hey, how do people think about 2021 as you get, whether you're thinking about main event prep or you're thinking about a satellite league or a DC. So kind of walk us through, Brian, kind of that league and who's involved and what are your biggest takeaways from a league like that? When it's, some people may scratch their head and say, you're drafting, you know, 7 months before baseball begins. How can that be so beneficial?
Well, we're all pretty hardcore, so it's in our blood, you know, the fantasy baseball or baseball in general. So it's a test because of the skill of the players. And it's a fab league. So, you know, there is some forgiveness for some picks, which every year, I mean, you know, sadly we've had players die after we've drafted them. And obviously
that's
players.
That's not good.
No, it's happened a couple of times, unfortunately. Players get injured, players retire. So the first fab is always a bloodbath. I would guess 50-60% of the entire league budget is blown that first fab, just people repairing their rosters. But no, it's fun. It's, you know, you're kind of, the player pool is pretty fresh in your mind. Yep. So there could be some recency bias with some of the picks. The one thing I really like about the league is we do this draft September, October, whatever, and each year we hit the first round pretty good. So there's no wild, like, oh, my God, you know, we picked that guy number 14 and his ADP is 62 or something. We do a pretty good job the first couple rounds, and then maybe it varies a little bit because, again, free agency, injuries, yeah, et cetera. But, no, I think it's a great practice. Again, the player pool is pretty fresh. You have some young players that you've seen maybe in September, and, you know, you're going to make a call on them. You're going to guesstimate that they're going to get the playing time the following year. They're going to continue to grow, or you didn't like what you saw, and it's sure, a big name, but you're going to fade it because, I didn't really like what I saw in his swing, or, you know, I didn't like his repertoire pitching-wise. And anyway, that's my take on it.
Well, and what did you learn, Brian, when you guys did, like, your first-round picks, for example? It sounds like that was pretty accurate for you from how the first-round ADP ended up playing out when we got to kind of that February, March time frame before everything got shut down?
Yeah. This year, I think Dan texted us, Dan Kenyon, that we hit 13 of the 15.
Wow.
And the two we didn't hit were basically, essentially we hit 15 of the top 16 or 17. I mean, we really nailed it. And then, you know, got a little screwy after that, but we did a good job with that. I mean, back in team 15, this draft, I believe Dave Chauvin took Fernando Tatis.
Wow.
You know,
so the quote-unquote reach pick is working out okay as well.
Yeah, well, and then the sad thing is, because it was a fab league, it didn't play out, actually.
Right.
And, of course, we were drafting thinking, you know, hey, we're going to get 162 games, not this. But still, it was a, you know, he made a call on a young player. I'm usually pretty aggressive with the young players, so I could appreciate what he did. And, yeah, I mean, it would have paid off for him, so.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and that's always a hard thing I think people are trying to box balance is how do you balance risk? And, you know, I joked earlier on kind of my indoctrination, and I've talked about it ad nauseum on this podcast, so I won't beat it up too much. But I started last year with Aaron Judge, who I thought, you know, had all of the ability to kind of what he was going to do this year when he started off, but before he got hurt, and he got hurt last year. And certainly he did not provide first-round value. And then I followed that up with, you know, picking in a 12-team format and thinking that pitching was going to be thin, I really wanted to lock in a really early starter. So I drafted Trevor Bauer, and we all know that how that went last year. So I get it. But it's interesting that you guys were so accurate from that perspective because it just really goes to show that there's things you can learn in a league when that's, you know, that far out. So it's interesting that you guys could pick up on so many different things. But as you've gotten into that, you know, you think about that type of style, because that's essentially a 15-team satellite, is what you're saying, right, Brian? Or
yeah.
Okay. So do you have a favorite format that you enjoy playing? Do you like that 15-team, either main event or an MEQ style, or do you prefer, you know, the 12-team online? You've obviously had a ton of success, or more like a draft champions. What do you like the best?
I should probably say the online championship, because that's where I've had the most success, but it'll be the main event. The main event will always have a soft spot for me. You know, that's what we all want to win. We all want to win the main event.
Yeah.
And so it's my favorite. It's very social. You know, I go to Vegas and I see people that maybe I only see once a year, but we text or tweet each other quite often, and it's just good to catch up for a couple of days. No matter how cool you are there, you're still a fantasy nerd. I mean, that's it. So some of the whatever barriers or social are kind of peeled away. And for the most part, it's a very friendly, welcoming community. So
now, Brian, you do a draft that I think a very small group of hardcore players know about. I think it's run by Mike Masato, Mike the Mouth. Talk about that that team or that league. It's called, I think, the Midnight Madness Draft. How does that league work?
Yeah, so Mike has a party. You know, anybody's welcome to do it, to join. I mean, there is a cost to it, so, you know, there is a fee. But it's a good time. And so after the party, we say midnight, but it's probably about 11, 11:30. Greg and Tom and Derek hate it because one of them has to proctor it. It's Derek. We start drafting, and it's been an online championship style most years. I think last year it switched to basically a satellite league where it was winner pays first and second. It's 12 teams, just 12 owners that commit to it. And it's Friday night at midnight before the main event the next morning at 10 o'clock.
Got it.
And so it's, you know, we're all kind of amped up, even though it's late, and, you know, we're trying to fight off tiredness, but we're also pumped up, and
yeah,
it's a good time, and there's some really good drafters in there, really, 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 really good ones. So it's just a good little prep, and maybe some guys don't want to reveal too much because they're drafting, you know, the next morning, obviously, and some of them are drafting against each other.
As I was going to say, are you guys ever in the same main league the very next morning from the Mike the Mouth draft?
Yes, it happens. And, you know, me personally, I don't care. I mean, it is what it is. I'm going to take the player that I'm going to take. And you're going to take... strategy under wraps. But still, I mean, it's a free-for-all. And these guys are great players. And it's a good little challenge right before.
Sure. And Brian, how do do you play still in, you know, home leagues with buddies or things like we hear about, you know, Justin Mason talks about the Barf League out in San Francisco or any NL or AL only leagues. How do you manage those entries versus, you know, some of these more higher stakes entries?
The only home league I'm in now, all my home leagues have faded away basically. But I do an NL AL only. There are two teams, but you run them both, and then there's a combined overall. So we picked that up from – it was run by some NFBC veterans, and we kind of started our own. So it's NFBC rules, although it's a keeper league. So there you go. But that's a fun one, and one of them, the AL is a snake draft, and the NL is an auction. But we've been doing it, God – probably coming on 10 years. And so it's a good time. I look forward to it every year. We put this year on hiatus, but you know, we'll come back next year.
No, that sounds like a lot of fun. Those are always a good time. I still play in a couple of home leagues myself. We put my longstanding one, we put that on the back burner this year, but we still kept one going. So it's always good to keep playing those. There's really smart players in those leagues too, that you can still learn a lot of information, maybe even likely make you a better NFBC player, because they all got to come from somewhere, right? So
I could be a little arrogant sometimes or a little overconfident, and so it's good to be challenged and not have an echo chamber. So
for sure. Well, let's, Brian, let's dive in a little bit more on the strategy side. Now that we've understood kind of where you start maybe your draft prep, which I think some people, you know, would be surprised that it starts that early. Tell me about, as you and I have talked, your closer strategy. You know, I think we talked to Scott Jenstadt last week, and he was very adamant in his Oaks Corner piece on RotoWire, along with his pods, that he was just fearful overall of coming out of those drafts without closers because he wanted to make sure that he had those locked in. And then we talked to Toby, better known as Batflip Crazy, in our first podcast, and he kind of thought a little bit more of a wait-and-see approach, or he kind of wanted to let the draft come to him a little bit more. Where do you fall, Brian, between those two? Are you more like Scott? Are you more like Toby? And kind of what are you thinking from a process perspective?
Definitely more like Toby. The closer position, just it's so volatile. I think the retention rate for a closer from, you know, April to October is less than 50%. So even the top guys don't repeat year after year. I mean, Mariano Rivera was such an exception. I mean, I figure the elite closers have a 2 to 5 year run in them.
Yep.
Trying to catch that. So I, you know, I fade closers pretty heavily. Although, you know, I figure Josh Hader was my top target this year. And in a couple drafts early on, especially, he fell to a reasonable spot, I thought, 7th, 8th round. So I picked him up, even though I normally don't pick closers that early, or I kind of go on the cheap usually, 2nd, 3rd tier closers, but that was a good price. And then, you know, I think he was going 3rd round come when the drafts restarted, and that was a little too rich for my blood, no matter how good I thought he was. But
no, I think that makes sense. I mean, it can certainly be challenging from that perspective to try to figure out exactly where you're going to go and how you're going to fill that piece in. And so when you look at those, what do you focus on for maybe that next guy up? Because there's a lot of opinions on, you know, really finding who that next guy up is. Do you look for more of a velocity guy? Do you look for a guy that's closed in the past? Do you look for a guy that's maybe got a shaky role definition? How do you...
Definitely velocity, which is why, you know, there's certain guys I just don't even consider. And they're effective, and they do the job. It just confounds me how they're able to do it. But I look at velocity. I look at the age. I look at the, you know, I'm going to look at the pitch mix and just see what the heir apparent, you know, what's his age, what's his contract situation, you know, how has he been? And just take an educated guess. I mean, look at Nick Anderson this year. So many people were so high on him, but the Rays are the Rays.
Yeah.
I mean, even if he was the closer, they don't use a closer in a traditional role anyway. So if we extrapolate and this was a 162-game season, if you told me Nick Anderson was a closer, I would still guess he would have less than 20 saves just because there would be 3 or 4 guys with 7, 8, 9, and then him. So,
but for you, is that more contextual with that team's process, or you just –
No, look, it's even Atlanta. I mean, a lot of people are taking Will Smith, and – you know, I'm an Atlanta fan, and I don't want to say I know how they operate, but I had a pretty good suspicion Melanson was their guy.
Yeah.
People wanted to say, well, they signed Will Smith, and people forget that Atlanta bought the contract from San Francisco. They were paying Melanson a hell of a lot of money, too, if you wanted to go that way. But Atlanta is one of these teams that wasn't really going to mess around. They want their one guy in the 9th inning, and they're going to mix and match all the way up until then. So, yeah, you look at the team construct, look at the managerial styles, you know, try to parse all that in. And at the end of the day, you still miss on quite a few. Okay.
And is that something, Brian, this volatility, which, you know, I think our friend Alex Fast over at Pitcher List, you know, he's written about this too. It seems like it's becoming increasingly more volatile over the years. Have you always kind of developed this strategy, or is this something that's evolved over time for you?
It's evolved. I mean, when I first started, yeah, you wanted the two closer. I think the first 2 or 3 main events, you know, I probably had 2 or 3 closers before the, you know, 12th, 13th, 14th round. You know, I just wanted that stability. And then you see, oh, my guy lost his job by the end of April. and then you just see the trends where it was going. And so I've been fading them more and more and more and just taking chances on some spec plays, knowing that I'm going to fab, you know, I'm probably going to have to fab closers, which a lot of people don't want to do because it costs a lot of money, but
sure.
That's, I'm comfortable doing that. I'm comfortable having that approach. I don't want to put too much draft capital into the unknowns, basically. So,
yeah, no. I get that. And there, it's never a good feeling when you're having to kind of chase or come from behind the eight ball. And that closer position, like you said, you're definitely going to draft, and that one's going to be a challenge for sure. So you never know how that was going to play out. You hope that you get to beat some people to the punch in order to get that position locked up, but you kind of, you know, are always looking at kind of what that next step is, and it can be a little bit scary. So,
well, and this year, I mean, a guy that I was really high on that I tried to hit in every DC and every draft of importance was Karinchak. I mean,
yeah,
just the K rate, and I didn't really trust Brad Hand. Now, Brad Hand still has a job, but so Karinchak was somebody I invested quite heavily in, and
sure.
I don't really have any, I'm not really disappointed. He's been effective. He's gotten a save or two. And I think he's definitely next in line.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just do that, but there was so many, teams that had nobody that was a defined closer coming into the year. Was, I know a lot of people said, oh, I wanted to get the security, and I'm like, what are you talking about? There's five or six teams that we don't even know who the closer is.
Right.
And then you got five or six teams with shaky closers going into the, you know, it just seemed absurd to invest that much into such an unknown.
No, it definitely makes sense. And I think, Brian, that continues on a theme. It sounds like, for the most part, you have, especially in a 12-team format, you have been pretty against drafting a closer in the first round. Is that a fair way to state kind of your pitching philosophy?
Oh, you mean just a pitcher?
Yes.
I definitely don't draft a closer in the first round.
I would hope not. I would definitely hope not. But as far as a starting pitcher, are you going to be a Gerrit Cole, or this year, heck, it may have been Justin Verlander. It could have been Jacob DeGrom.
No.
Have that in the first round?
I like Jacob DeGrom. Jacob DeGrom was my number one pitcher. If, depending on where I was drafting, I would have taken him. And in one league, I think he fell to 8 or 9, and I do have one share of DeGrom. And I have one share of Cole, so I think I'd pick 9 or 10. But other than that, I don't like to spend such a high draft pick. And I get it. They're just as important. And having that horse, especially in this day and age, is something, but it's just not something I normally do. And then I'm an ageist on top of it. So Verlander and Scherzer weren't really on my board at all. And, you know, I just don't want to be there when the music stops. So I've missed out on some great seasons by some older pitchers. And older players in general. I mean, I keep missing Nelson Cruz because, like, okay, when's this going to stop? But
yeah, I think we all kind of have that. What's crazy is if you drafted probably in February, you still got Nelson Cruz in, like, that 90 to 100 range, which is just bananas.
It was painful because I'm drafting and I have my players that I like to get at certain points. And he's there every rant, you know, 7, 8, 9, and I'm going, Jesus, can I keep passing on him? And I go, ah, you know what? Look at him. He's X years old, and
yeah.
It just goes against what I believe in, and sure enough, here he is. He's the best player on the Twins again.
Yeah, he just did his 7th home run tonight. So crazy. Well, but that doesn't mean, obviously, that you're not investing, obviously, in starting pitching, and certainly as I've gotten to know you better, Brian, you're not one of those guys that necessarily are one of those players that wants to wait crazy late either. I don't know that I've talked to you and heard about a whole lot of your drafts where, you know, you've taken hitters in the first 7 picks or 8 picks or anything in that form. So kind of what, and this is obviously very loose and open to interpretation, but kind of what is your overall draft strategy with pitchers if you're not going to take one super early? How do you kind of, like you talked about earlier, which I think everybody should do, to an extent, is how do you map out your pitching strategy and what is an ideal strategy for you as you map it out?
So I was, in most of the early drafts, you know, I was looking to take my pitcher in the third round. Now, it all depends on where I'm drafting, really. But I wanted, you know, I was comfortable taking hitters the first couple rounds and then taking my first starting pitcher. And that evolved that by March, when I was planning to do all the events in Vegas, the main events and online championships, I was definitely of the opinion I didn't care what it took. I was definitely going to have a pitcher, you know, in the second round. I didn't think I could wait to the third. You know, a couple of my friends that I talked to and that are high-stakes players and really good themselves, they were comfortable waiting to the third or fourth, and that wasn't me. I just pitching is not my forte. I mean, some years I strike gold, and some years, I don't strike anything. So I had some targets. I mean, I knew, obviously, you know, Scherzer and Verlander were off my board, but they were going so high anyway. And I wasn't going to get Cole and DeGrom. So Bieber was a guy. I have a couple shares. Clevinger even. Luis Castillo. Walker Buehler. You know, a couple of those guys totally missed. But, you know, Blake Snell was another target of mine. And then on top of it, I just tried to stack them up. I'm not one of those guys that takes their pitcher and then, okay, it goes offense the next six or seven rounds.
Yeah.
I want to capitalize and keep adding to it, and so I can have a solid three or four option.
Yeah.
Because I think I can find offense. I think I'm a pretty good offensive drafter and fabber, but it's definitely pitching, which is not my – I wouldn't say it's my strength.
Well, Brian, I think it's hard because I found the same thing, and I think just in general, again, I do play more 12 teams than I do 15. I think what I have learned for me, and I think Toby said this really well, you know, you have to think of this as accumulating a set of numbers, and the coolest thing is there are plenty of ways to win this game, and there are plenty of strategies that can do it, but you have to know what you yourself are both strong and weak at, and I think that's important that you've identified what that is, because I fall into the same mold that you do. I have an easier time finding hitters on the waiver wire than I do on pitchers. And so for me, you know, I went a little bit light on pitching, and it's no surprise that I had a really bad year from a fantasy perspective in the NFBC. But there are other people that are really good at it and really skilled at it. So definitely very interesting perspective from as you think about that. So, Brian, we've got a couple of really good listener questions. I've got a four-pack for you that I want to dive into before we wrap things up. And I think they're all really interesting and can give us a whole lot of insight. First is a really good question. First two I'm going to pick on are from Friends with Fantasy Benefits. First is from Randy Haynes. He's at Randy Haynes 22 on Twitter. Great follow, really sharp baseball mind. His question for you, Brian, was, as we are now entering week five of the regular season, and for those that are scoring at home, we have 10 total weeks. So we are entering week five. We will have five more to go. As you go to fab, what is the least amount of fab that you are comfortable with? And do you have any quirky stories or scenarios where, I don't know that having too much fab is always a great place to be, but maybe for a lot of people, they feel like they're in this bind where you got to be super aggressive. Have you been in a bind with not a whole lot of fab? I know Randy and I were catching up before the podcast, and Brian, he's in a little bit of a pickle where he may have under $100 of fab left for the rest of the year.
That would make me a little uncomfortable. I mean, to answer the question directly, I'd like to, I mean, minimum $100 now, basically $20 a week, because it means I spent $900 and hopefully I spent that $900 wisely. And so all I'm doing is supplementing, you know, the random, you know, COVID that comes up or the random injury or whatnot, but that I should have a pretty strong foundation if I've spent that much already. So 100 would be about the limit where I'd be comfortable at, and preferably about 250. So I can have about $50 per week. I mean, some weeks I might want to blow or not blow, but spend over 100, but to have that 50 average.
And do you have like checkpoints in mind, Brian, that you want to have a, obviously, that you necessarily don't feel like you have to specifically have this mapped out in your mind, but do you want to have X amount by a certain time, or do you use, have you ever used something like that at all to understand?
Not really. It's more of a mental checklist, I guess, in my head. I mean, I know I've had teams where just I'm chasing pitching the whole season, and I just know I don't have enough money. I mean, I just, it's going to run out. I mean, in theory, I have enough money, but I'm not ever going to get the guys All-Star break. I'm not going to get the guys I need just because I don't have that. So it's all depends on, I mean, I always have money at the end of the year. I mean, not a whole lot. There's some years I run it down to zero, or, you know, I'm very close to it. And I don't think I've been too wasteful. I mean, sometimes you're really high on a guy and you make a bid and you think it's pretty, a pretty solid bid. And it is a solid bid. You just, you know, maybe you overspent, but you'll look around and you'll see that the guy you overspent on went about the same amount in various leagues, but just in your league, nobody was interested in him but you.
Sure. So. Nope, I get it. Brian, I have to pause and tell you, I just saw one of the strangest things I've ever seen in a professional baseball game. Kyle Schwarber with two strikes just tried to bunt and bunted the ball about 140 feet foul past the Cubs dugout for a strikeout.
That's pretty impressive.
I don't know. Genesis Cabrera was pitching, who's a lefty for the Cardinals that throws just absolute smoke. I don't know if he was terrified of being up at the plate or what was going on.
Oh, this was a Randy Johnson, a John Kruk All-Star game moment?
There was no chance that was going to work out well, but I thought I would comment.
Yeah. I'll have to check that out later.
Yeah. Okay, Greg Blankenship has a question as far as, you know, your premature draft starts in like 4 weeks, right, Brian?
Yes. Well, in theory, yes. I'll be talking with Dan to try to get a date down, but yes, it'll be starting in the next, I guess, 4 or 5 weeks.
Okay. So how do you think this year, things like injuries or others, and I want to give you a scenario that Greg had, which I thought was really interesting. His question centered around a guy like Jesus Luzardo, which I know you love Jesus Saves for the Oakland Athletics, being a guy from the Bay Area. He was allegedly to have 130 innings cap in 2020. For guys like that, how are you thinking about what that impact is for 2021? And, I mean, just overall that landscape of things like injuries, or, I mean, can you even start to peg things like that? Or is that, you
know? As far as that goes, these young guys, the Luzardo, even the Dustin Mays, the, few names escaping me right now. I'm treating 2021 as I was going to treat 2020. I mean, Luzardo was hopefully going to get that 130, 140 innings this year, and then next year that 170-ish. And I can't see him going more than 120, 130 next year.
Yeah.
They're going to be delicate with him. And it sucks because these guys have these great electric arms, but they're not stretched out. And it's a weird game anyway, with managers feeling comfortable. Just, okay, you hit 80 pitches, you're out of the game, whether that be the sixth inning or the third inning. And it doesn't matter how well, as far as the walks and hits go, or the base runners, it's just you've hit that magic number. And you know, I've taken a step further. I'm really high on the Detroit arms with Manning and Scooble and Eyes and Mackenzie Gore, although I didn't think Mackenzie Gore would be much of a factor this year. I thought next year, but, you know, now I'm pushing that back because they're just not going to have the innings this year. And these teams aren't going to, you know, just push these blue chippers like they, you know, like Dwight Gooden in 84, 250 innings. I mean, just not going to happen. So.
Yep. No, I agree with you there. It's going to be interesting to see how this whole thing's out, because on one hand, you could say, okay, well, they got their cup of coffee, they got their feet wet, right? And they're going to come up. But is this really going to be any different? Is it going to be drastically different for their development? I'm not sure. But I can tell you, as just a fan of baseball, I'm excited to see what happens. And I think that's going to be fun. So.
Yeah, I think we are definitely, as somebody who's watched baseball since, you know, whatever, 7, 8 years old, I won't date myself too much, but several years ago, several decades. And I think I have an appreciation of the game and the history. And my lifetime, I think this is definitely as far as the young talent, arguably the most at one time. And just with the electric players, the Acuñas and the Tatis and Sotos, I mean, they're so fun to watch.
Yeah.
And the pitchers, and it's a really dynamic time. It sucks that baseball does such a crappy job marketing itself and marketing the star players, whether they be young or old. But it really is a great time to be a fan because you're watching something special. And these kids coming up are ready to play from the get-go. And that's just fun to see as well.
No, I definitely agree. And speaking of a young kid, we had a reader question from somebody I played college baseball with, Joe Vanzo. Shout out to Joe. His question was, if you think about a young guy like Dylan Moore, you know, he's somebody that we both own. The data looks really interesting on him right now. The StatCast data, he's a StatCast darling. But nice power-speed combo, racked up huge numbers in college, then had been banged up in the minors. Do you think that Dylan Moore could be a top eight second baseman in 2021?
Yeah, I was thinking a top eight seems really aggressive, but, you know, that's when I factor in the Altuve, Hira, Albiz, Jeff McNeil, although I don't know if Jeff McNeil will qualify next year, Arod, you know, there's a ton of guys. So top eight seems really aggressive, but I also think he's one of these guys that is going to have a nice season this year that'll probably go overlooked next year. So he definitely has the potential to end up that way. I mean, I'm not going to say he will, but I also think you're not going to have to pay for him as a top eight second baseman. I still think no matter his versatility and what he accomplishes this year, people are just going to go, Dylan Moore was fluky.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to get him, you know, fairly cheaply next year. Well, I'll let you know in a few weeks where he goes.
Yeah. But,
I think the potential is there, but I don't think you're going to have to pay for it either from a fantasy perspective.
Sure. No, that makes sense. All right, our last question before we let you go or anything else that you want to touch on, certainly we're happy to discuss it, but is from our old buddy Scott Genstead over at RotoWire, who was on last week with us, and his question is, so dating back to the painful 2018 season where, you know, a great year for you, but you've ended up finishing third instead of that elusive first, is there anything that sticks out, that one move you could have made that you think would have put you over the top in the last week or anything you would have done differently? Or is it just a matter of you had a great year and you got caught?
I think it's just a matter of I had a great year and I got caught. The one thing, I didn't have the best closers. I got a little lucky in the first half. I had Sean Doolittle and, ironically enough, I can't even remember the second guy. And I actually had a third.
He was that good, huh?
But he was good, actually.
Oh, okay.
And then Doolittle got hurt, and it was just, oh, he hurt his foot or something. It was right around the All-Star break, and I just assumed, okay, it's going to, you know, with the break and everything, I'm going to be without closer for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then the other guy, I believe, got hurt as well. And I wasn't ultra aggressive picking up another closer. I had a third one. None of these guys were getting a ton of run, but I had a comfortable lead in the league. And those guys had done so well in the first half. I had a decent number. And I just wasn't aggressive in getting that that extra closer. And I remember when I realized I had to, it was August. And I go, well, you know, it's getting a little tighter. I should probably just, you know, Doolittle's not coming back, apparently. And I got outbid. It was stupid. I mean, I really needed that, and I should have spent more money. And I spent a lot, but I still came up short. And I don't know if it would have made a big difference in the overall, to be honest, but that's the one move I can point to.
Okay.
Anything else, I thought I did pretty well. I mean, I had a good offense. I had good pitching anyway. But that would be the move.
Got it. Well, still, you had a great year. Certainly nothing to hang your head about, but those are painful. And third is painful when you get past that late. So great question from Scott. I know he's enjoyed some great success too.
Yeah, Scott's a great player and a nicer guy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Brian, we really appreciate you coming on. Sorry you had to suffer through it with me only. You didn't have Matthew. but we appreciate the time. It's always great to hear from some people that have had success and hear kind of what their process is, what they've done that's been interesting. Really appreciate the time. Best of luck the rest of the year, and hopefully, are you in a main this year, or did you end up not doing one with kind of the quirkiness of this year?
Did not do a main. Okay. Just doing the OC.
Got it. Well, I was going to wish you good luck on your first, hopefully, main title, but that might have to wait until 2021.
Yeah, that'll have to wait.
But, all right. Well, thanks a lot, Brian, for catching up. And for all our listeners, thanks again. Please rate, subscribe, and review the podcast. We will touch base later this week. I think Matthew will be back, but stay tuned on that one. And then we'll have our fab podcast over the weekend. So thanks, as always, for listening.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast with the two Matts. Please rate, subscribe, and review the podcast, and we hope you listen again soon.